Of all the planets in the solar system, Mars has been the one that has most captured our imagination and curiosity. From the ancient canals reported in 1877 by Giovanni Schiaparelli to evidence of ancient water revealed by the current Mars rovers, Spirit and Opportunity, Mars continues to be fertile ground for scientific exploration. Generations of science fiction writers have been fascinated with the idea of life on Mars, too. By the end of the 19th century, H.G. Wells' The War of the Worlds had technologically advanced Martians invading Earth. In the early 1900s, Edgar Rice Burroughs' series of Mars novels, known as The Martian Tales, followed the adventures of a Confederate Civil War veteran transported to Mars to live among its inhabitants. And 50 years ago, in Ray Bradbury's The Martian Chronicles, humans invade the ancient advanced civilization on Mars. Well, not to be outdone, contemporary science fiction writers have imagined humans traveling to Mars, colonizing the planet, sometimes terraforming it, adding water, air, and an atmosphere so the planet becomes habitable for us. This hour, we're broadcasting from the new Science Fiction Museum and Hall of Fame in Seattle, and we'll be talking about how Mars has been imagined by science fiction writers and what scientists are learning about our closest neighbor in the solar system. Can one inform the other? So if you'd like to join our conversation, give us a call. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. And if you're here in the audience at the Science Fiction Museum, you can step up to the mic to ask a question. As always, you can surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com. Let me introduce my guest. Dr. Donna Shirley is a former manager of NASA's Mars Exploration Program. She's the director of the Science Fiction Museum and Hall of Fame in Seattle. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Gregory Benford is a Nebula Award-winning author. His books include The Martian Race, published by Warner Books in 1999, and Timescape. He's also a professor of plasma physics and astrophysics at the University of California, Irvine. Welcome to the program.
Hello.
Hey, hi. Greg Baer, he's a Hugo and Nebula Award-winning author from Linwood, Washington, whose books include Moving Mars, Darwin's Children, and Deadlines. Welcome to the program, Greg.
Good to be here. Thank you.
And on the line with us is Albert Haldeman. He is deputy project scientist for the Mars Exploration Rover and the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, and he joins us from the studios of KPCC in Pasadena. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
Thank you. Let me begin with you and talk about the museum a little bit, Donna. What made you decide to move from the pure world of science and take the position as the head of the Science Fiction Museum? And you're dressed very nicely with, you can't see on the radio, but nice science fiction garb you have on.
Yeah, well, the director of the Science Fiction Museum has to have, this is a Guy Nin robe, like Whoopi Goldberg wore in Star Trek. And B. Joe Trimble, who is on our advisory board, made this.
Very nice.
Well, I've always been a science fiction fan. I mean, since I was 11 years old, I started reading science fiction. And there was one science fiction book in the library in Wynnewood, Oklahoma, which is population 2,500 where I grew up. And I checked that book out of the library and read it 20 times. And I cannot remember the name of it. But right after that, I started reading Bradbury and Clark and Heinlein, and just basically fell in love with the idea of space travel. And, of course, this was well before we actually had space travel. So I retired from the Jet Propulsion Lab in 98. I went to the University of Oklahoma and spent 4 years as an assistant dean of engineering. And my daughter lives in Seattle, and for some reason she refused to abandon her husband and move to Oklahoma. So I was forced to move to Seattle if I wanted to see much of her. So I came here. I was asked to be on the advisory board, and then they said they needed a director, and I just thought it would just be too much fun to turn down.
That's great. That's great. So do you find that there is this intersection between, you know, like you always thought there was, between science fiction and science?
Absolutely. In fact, that's a big theme of the Science Fiction Museum, is that intersection. We have an exhibit, for instance, specifically called Not So Weird Science, which is about people who've written about genetic engineering and nanotechnology and movies about that, and then how that science is really coming along, because just a few years ago, nobody would have believed we could have machines the size of the atoms. And the Fantastic Voyage, Isaac Asimov thing, nobody would have thought that was possible, but hey, we're getting there.
Yeah, and Mars is always such a great topic to talk about, right? Mars is a prime source of science fiction material.
Absolutely. Another exhibit we have, my favorite, of course, is The Changing Face of Mars. And we have in there the relationship between science and science fiction about Mars over the years, as you mentioned about Arthur C. Clarke, and or about Edgar Rice Burroughs and so on, right. And we have that whole story.
You know, Gregory Benford, I was reading your book, The Martian Race, and what struck me was just page one, the whole thing takes place on Gusev Crater, of all places, which is where one of the rovers is as we speak, right? I mean, did you do that and cooperate? Did you know that, or was this science imitating fiction or fiction imitating science? What was going on here?
And people say science fiction doesn't predict. I was working on the book with Elizabeth Malartra, and we looked at the long list of sites, possible sites for the opportunity to land, and Spirit. And Gusev jumped out as an obviously watery site, an ancient crater that plainly looks as though it had lake beds of varying depths. So it looked like a good place to go. And just made it up. I went talked to the people at NASA who were working on Gusev, people like Natalie Cabron, who, in fact, forced Gusev up to the top of the candidate list. And therefore, it's a short-range prediction.
And so you know you knew they were gonna land there when you were writing the book?
No,
you didn't.
No, it wasn't decided until 2002.
Yeah, very very shortly before launch, actually.
So you were omniscient about this, prescient or whatever you would like. You knew in advance. So this
we say Gregory is spooky.
Spooky action.
Well, he did have the odds in his favor.
Well, it was ranked 55 in the list of candidates when we started to look at it.
Albert Haldeman, how do you
react? It came to the top pretty quick.
Tell us about
it. I think it, the process of landing site selection, the favorites became clear. I don't know when the book was where in its publication cycle, but probably a year before its final selection, we had a pretty good idea that the top favorites were Gusev and the Meridiani site where Opportunity went. The question about Gusev all along, though, was because it's this crater, it has slope winds, and the winds were always high. So, in fact, it wasn't until we'd gone quite a way through the development process that we mm-hmm. felt it was a safe enough site to actually get to with our landing system. So, it was a favorite of the scientists, but whether it was going to make it in from the engineering concerns of safety was mm-hmm. a question for quite a while.
And Greg Baer, in Moving Mars, it was published a few years before Pathfinder. Did you have that same kind of?
1993.
Yeah.
You know, we read all the stuff all the scientists gather, and we read all their speculations and what they know, and then we put it into our fiction, and that gives us a good heads up on this whole thing. So, I think that what I was looking at was books like Mars, published by the University of Arizona Press, and large volumes like that, and scanning them scrupulously and saying, well, I think I believe this, and I think I don't believe that. That's how it works.
Mm-hmm. While I have you there, Albert, can you give us an update of what's going on with the rovers? They're getting into some pretty interesting things.
We're doing some fun stuff, Well, one's going down a hill and the other one's going up a hill. Opportunity is driven into Endurance Crater and is creeping down the very steep slopes that are, at about twice the gradient that where all the road signs tell the trucks to go into lowest gear. And looking at the stratigraphic column that's exposed in Endurance Crater. And Spirit has just arrived about a week ago at the base of the Columbia Hills, driven over 2 miles, 3.2 kilometers to get there. And it turns out we've found some nifty-looking rocks that we're going to be exploring for the next few days.
And these are you're now working what you call bonus time, right? You've gotten your main objectives done.
That's
and
right.
You're into bonus stuff where you might be putting the rovers a little bit more at risk.
There's a little bit of that. Certainly, we want to put this bonus time, the gravy, if you want, of the extended mission to get the best possible science. So mm-hmm. we're not going to take undue risks. But what we want to do is use these tools, these priceless assets on Mars, to best effect to increase our knowledge about these landing sites.
Mm-hmm. And there was some word that one of the rovers might have a little wheel problem. Is that
right? That's right. Spirit has a little bit of an arthritic wheel, the front right wheel, and so we're going to be taking care of that, try and slosh the lubricant around a little bit in the next few days, and then maybe also teach ourselves a little bit in our sandboxes at JPL to drive with just 5 of the 6 wheels, just so that we can save the wheels last 100, 200, or 300 meters of driving for when we really need it.
Mm-hmm. Gregory Benford, in your book, The Martian Race, you describe a Mars that is actually quite believable. And not so far future of 2018, if we're able to get there. The first manned mission goes to Mars, and people are living there for a while. And what's interesting about the plot and the structure is that NASA plays only a background role. There is a tension between the private industry that is funding this and NASA, and we seem to be heading a little bit more in that direction.
Yes, and I think it's a very good idea. Let's remember that, after all, the New World was discovered by people from Iceland, but they're not the ones who made something of it. And that could happen to Mars, too. Mm-hmm. I think if we don't seize the opportunity to send a probably manned expedition within a few decades. Because the thrust of the Mars Prize, as in the Martian race, and that's a deliberate pun, it's about both the race to Mars and the life they find there, mm-hmm. is to discover whether life lurks beneath the soil, which we don't know, although there is more and more promising evidence. The recent result from the European Mars Express detecting methane in the atmosphere is extremely exciting and hard to explain, actually, without a leakage from subsurface life.
Mm-hmm. And you talk about spaceships, Greg Baer, solutions for travel in the 2070s, travel between the Earth, the Moon, and Mars. And creative solutions for getting there. Are they possible?
I think so, yeah. One of our problems with long-term spaceflight is medical and biological. We just really haven't conquered the research yet on making it easy and safe and healthy to travel in space for 2 years or more. So some of the more impressive speculations about space travel imply that we should have ships with chambers on tethers that create at least a fairly substantial G-force, something more like what we're used to, spinning around each other. My concern is that at some point, certainly in my novel, we create alternate biochemistries for our astronauts so that they can actually stay healthy in space. And I think mm-hmm. that'll be doable within 20 or 30 years, too.
1-800-999-8255 is our number. Let's go to the phones, and please come to the microphones. If you have a question, ask Chuck in Oklahoma City. Hi, Chuck.
Hi, Donna. Chuck Lauer here. Wanted to congratulate you on your new appointment and get your reaction to the Aldrich Commission report, and in particular the private sector involvement that's called for in the Bush Moon Mars Initiative.
Hi, Chuck. Good to hear from you.
Yeah, I don't know if you heard we got our deal closed.
Yeah, but I heard that. Congratulations.
Thank you.
A little shop talk.
I know,
we can't avoid it.
We're one of the other XPRIZE competitors, a company called Rocket Plane Limited. So we're a competitor of Bert and Paul on the suborbital human space flight stuff.
Yeah. The Aldrich Commission, I was rather pleased to see that they took my congressional testimony rather verbatim.
Is that right?
Yeah. I testified on March 10th. And one of the things I said was that we needed to involve private enterprise more because, you know, if we just keep doing things the way we're doing them, we'll never do it. I said that I thought the NASA centers needed to be made into FFRDCs, and they recommended that. I haven't had a chance to read the whole report yet, but certainly some of the stuff they picked up that I already testified about is very promising to me.
Do you think that there's going to be involvement in the? You think that NASA will pick up on the report itself?
Well, I think they'll have to.
Yeah.
And I think that they've already started moving somewhat in that direction. You know, they're talking about prizes. Now, I personally think that prizes are all very well, but unless NASA's willing to just get out of the way and really let it happen, you know, and NASA's a big, clumsy bureaucracy, so it remains to be seen.
All right. Thanks for calling. We're going to have to take a short break and come back and just getting warmed up talking about Mars, Mars and science fiction. If you've got questions, please get on the line, 1-800-989-8255. If you're here in the audience, we'll get right to you after this break. So stay with us. Don't go away. We'll be right back. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking about science and science fiction this hour from Seattle with my guest, Donna Shirley, director of the Science Fiction Museum and Hall of Fame in Seattle, Gregory Benford, a Nebula Award-winning author of science fiction books, and Greg Baer, Hugo, a Nebula Award-winning author, and Albert Haldeman, deputy project scientist for the Mars Exploration Rover at the JPL in Pasadena. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. Greg, I want to get to a line in your book, which I brought it up a little bit in the last hour, but one of your characters says, "Unfortunately, most of the sci-fi movies are about all the bad things that could happen."
Sure.
Invading monsters make a better movie.
Oh, yeah. Well, conflict is the point of drama. Of course, in real life, you never want conflict or danger, but the whole idea of adventure is somebody else getting into trouble some distance away.
But there are instances of science fiction, they're uplifting, good things are happening. I mentioned Close Encounter, the Third Kind.
Sure.
But they're far and in between.
But good things come out of conflict and rising above it. Mm-hmm. That's why Mars represents, for I think, this next generation, the great scientific goal that actually has a good scientific point. The quest to find out whether life originated and survived there. And I think that can only be done with a manned expedition. Robots are simply incapable of doing subsurface exploration for the foreseeable future. Donnie. And I know that's not the NASA point of view, but...
Donnie, you're shaking your
so
head.
So what?
Greg, you're wrong.
Yeah, well, show me a robot that can crawl down a thermal vent. We've tried it on Earth. It doesn't even work here.
No, but in fact, I was on a proposal for the 2007 Scout missions, and we were going to drill 20 meters.
Yeah.
And it's perfectly good, reasonable technology.
Oh, you can drill, but you can't descend.
An idea that I'll throw in here where I'm sort of in between on this being... Hi. I'm sort of in between on this, being working on the rovers, being a fan of human exploration, that I think working together, and that's actually part of the Aldrich Report's recommendations, robots, humans with robots would be a very fruitful way to proceed, and figuring out how to do that right. In particular, my own opinion is that, and what I haven't seen explicitly stated, is getting what makes us unique, or part of what makes us unique, is that we're tool users, we're tool builders, and what really will accelerate the discovery process on another world is not only sending astronauts with tools or humans with robots that do work, but designing those robots in such a way that the humans who are there can modify them drastically to increase the rate at which answers are received. My example for this is with Opportunity. We know we've got these sulfates. We know one of the minerals in the sulfate, but understanding the detail of the sulfate evaporite deposits in Meridiani, we'd need to know what all the minerals are. Well, you can all wait for at least 6 years for that answer. Whereas if you had tools that could be modified in place by humans, then you could actually get that answer quicker, and the rate of information return would be greatly accelerated. So I think it's the working together that's really going to be the fruitful approach to use.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to this gentleman here at the microphone. Yes, sir.
Hi. I was recently watching the Discovery Channel, and they were talking about hypotheses about... water frozen beneath the surface of Mars, and as the universe grows older and the sun begins to age and get hotter, it might actually start melting beneath the surface and may even give rise to, like, say, an atmosphere and other things such as that, stuff that might be compatible to life. I was wondering if there's any truth behind that. And second, just a really quick one also, is if you start involving private companies in searching Mars and it becomes more common to explore, will we be seeing, like, land grabs, and and how will we even begin to really solve those conflicts?
I like the idea of Tharsis Uplift Company myself.
Yeah.
Albert, did you want to jump in?
I can take the first one. I'll leave the second one to someone else. The first one, there is water on Mars now. There are water ice caps at both poles, we also have evidence from the Odyssey orbiter of near subsurface frozen water, and the volume calculations of the southern polar layered terrains, where we think a lot of this subsurface ice is held. The volume calculation suggests that if you took that ice and spread it over Mars, you'd have 10 to 20 meters or 30 to 60 feet of water depth over the entire planet. So I guess if you warmed that all up, it would turn to a 20-meter depth ocean over the whole planet equivalent, or you could evaporate it and have vapor phase in the atmosphere. Of course, the sun warming up to do that by itself is a long way off, and in human time scales, it's billions of years away. So we'll probably mine that water long before then, I think.
What about the, you see this frequently in Mars science fiction films and movies now, and people who say, you know, scientists say this is possible to actually make the rocket fuel for the return out of the water on Mars. Is that possible, Greg? Can you do that?
Yeah, you can make a methane rocket by taking some hydrogen there or getting it out of the water.
Right.
And make good old methane and oxygen.
Albert, you agree? Is that something?
There've been demonstrations of the kind of chemical reactors you need, the Sabatier reaction running on Earth, and it's a plan, or it's been proposed at least to take a reactor like that to do a demonstration on a lander on Mars.
But let me address it to Donna and to you. But you know, for years you hear people coming up with creative solutions and suggesting these things. We get them on the program all the time to NASA, but NASA wants to go with the what they call the Erector Set. You know, we're going to bring that stuff with us. We're not going to take a chance and get that stuff off of Mars, you know. We're going to build a habitat on the moon that's, you know, withstand a meteorite impact instead of burying it underground and covering it over with something that might be cheaper.
That may have been the case in the past. I think at the moment the current thinking is to really try and look at in-situ resource utilization. The question is really identifying if the resources are there. For the moon, for example, there's an idea that there may be water in the polar areas. I don't think there's as much as some other people think there is.
For various reasons
we could go into. But that's the kind of questions we need to understand scientifically. We need to understand whether there are potential resources there before we go and design the cities that will rely on the resources.
Do we have
shortages of water in Los Angeles?
Do we have the probes now that we see that, you know, the evidence of past water? Do we have the probes that can answer that question? Just how much water, useful water, might there be on Mars to exploit for, let's say, rocket fuel? Albert.
To get the answer, to understand exactly what the state of that water is, the Phoenix mission, the lander in 2007, will go to high northern latitudes and will dig in the subsurface, and we'll get the answer of what is the state of the ice in the near subsurface there. There are instruments both on the Mars Express Orbiter, the European Space Agency mission, and then on the next NASA orbiter, Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, that are going to take a look at depth, whether we can find, using radar, ground-penetrating radar, to see if we can see... groundwater tables. So we are trying, that's part of the program, is to catalog the water resources on Mars.
Okay, let me get a phone call from Perry in Salt Lake City. Hi, Perry.
Hi.
Hi, go ahead.
From a layman's perspective, other than some high drama in getting there, it seems like putting a man on the moon didn't really produce much for the populace, and the public interest seemed to shift to the shuttle and the International Space Station. So I'm wondering if your panelists think that that may have something to do with the lack of popular interest in President Bush's proposal for a manned mission to Mars.
People just don't see any reason to do it.
There's a real
effect. Sort of like we didn't really get much out. And as a matter of fact, they were just commenting on how we still don't know about certain water on the moon and things like that. So why not sort of deal with what's in our own backyard before we go so far out?
Greg Bear?
There's a real effect in actually being there. When something becomes part of your environment and you see it and it becomes important to your subconscious, you observe much more closely. When you see something on a screen or when you see information conveyed from a remote object, you just don't have that intimate connection with it. And your brain, even though it's thoroughly engaged, is just not quite as engaged when something can leap out and grab you. And that's why it's important to have people go to these places. And as we see these XPRIZE competitions develop, we're going to have more and more people over the decades begin to be able to pay their way into space or win a raffle and get into space. And so we'll have more and more popular participation. The problem the space program has had so far is the filtering process. We don't really believe any one of us can go. As soon as you believe that you can go there, there will be a real competition and a real interest in getting out there.
Mm-hmm. Anybody else want to make a comment?
Well, it's also true that for the first time, I think, in the evolution of modern times, modern civilization, I think humanity is losing its frontiers. We've just about walked all over this planet, and of course there's a lot to be done in the oceans, but something happens to society without frontiers, and I don't think we want to find out what that is, because we've seen it happen in the past, and it was not altogether good.
Mm-hmm.
Part of the West is about the opening out into a frontier, and I think we ought to try to keep that in our culture.
As far as the land grab thing, I think both Gregs have talked about, you know, the kind of civilization you would actually build on Mars. You might want to say something about that.
Yes. Well, some people seem to be afraid that you would own something of a distant place. But, you know, if you argued that we should have had North America be without property, how would you feel about the house you were living in right now?
There is a commitment to ownership, after all.
Yeah, it really is true. And Mars has the same surface area as the Earth because it doesn't have any oceans.
In moving Mars, I created some years down the road, about 160 or so years down the road, a corporate culture where corporations and families merge to form what's called binding multiples. And this seemed to me a fairly good possibility for an offshoot of our own culture, and with quite a different social point of view, that your family is your corporation. And I think that in that sense, then what is private ownership is also spread around a large number of people. And in my view of Mars also, instead of building stuff on the surface, there's lots of rock on Mars, and it's very cheap. Why not just dig down? So my Martians think of themselves as red rabbits. They live underground. They go from place to place through these tunnels. Their psychology is based on that. And going up and standing on the surface is a real adventure for them, just like it would be for a prairie dog or a rabbit.
It's like going outside in Manhattan.
Ooh.
I was thinking Montreal, but
I'll let that pass. 1-800-989-8255 is our number. But one interesting thing about discovering, you know, using real science as applied to outer space is the discovery about how tough the microbes are here on Earth and how that might increase the possibility of finding other tough guys someplace else.
Yeah. We're... You know, we're mean and we're ugly, but we're damned hard to kill. And I expect that's true
of
anything.
Speak for yourself, then.
Okay.
The first two. Speak for yourself.
I think that's certainly true of any subsurface life on Mars. It has survived in an atmosphere, well, no atmosphere. And if it has made it this far, that tells us something profound about life in the universe. And if it had a different origin, even more profound.
Well, and it's like, you know, again, science fiction talked about life on Mars. We've speculated about every kind of life on Mars. And now there's a whole field of astrobiology that didn't even exist 10 years ago. Yeah.
We're talking about Mars this hour and Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Albert, you know, on the first Viking lander, I remember back then, and then they tried that experiment that sort of showed that there was not life, at least microbes living in the soil right by there when they sprinkled the stuff into the ground to see if they'd get any semblance of life. Do you think that kind of experimentation should be done again, maybe with new kinds of instruments? And are we missing that opportunity by not having something like that on a rover once it gets there?
I think we're headed to doing similar things again. The Mars Science Laboratory, the next rover, is planned, or is the call requests instruments for an analytical laboratory on the surface again. And we've made a lot of progress technologically since the era when the Viking instruments were built. So we might get different answers this time around. We're going to be a whole lot more careful about cleaning and forward contamination, so that the science, since we are looking, we might be looking for biological signatures, so that we do it right. And that's a tough thing to do, to make sure everything is really, really clean at the level you would want if you're looking at the, you know, parts per billion level for organics.
You know, there are still...
So yeah, that's coming up.
There are still minority opinions running around the web from scientists who think that they actually did show signs of life on that experiment.
That's right. It is still somewhat disputed, but I think the way to address that dispute is to do a different experiment, to do another experiment where you address the concerns of the calibration concerns and the instrumental concerns that are out there and that seem to weigh that most scientists have. In order to ask the question, just because it is so important, it's so exciting to think, you know, that we might find life on another planet. I mean, my personal thing is, we know that Earth and Mars exchange spit. We've got Martian meteorites on Earth.
I have one right here in the museum.
I imagine is, well, there you go. But I sort of imagine, well, if life did get started on Mars, maybe we're all just Martian immigrants.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I wanted to say that the purpose of the whole program of the Mars Exploration Program, which I ran for 4 years, is to take those steps so that we look for water. because mm-hmm. everywhere on Earth there's water, there's life. And what Viking did was just land in the middle of a big desert and start digging, and surprise, there's nothing there. So what we're trying to do is find the wet spots, and then that's where you go look for life.
You know what I find interesting about the whole, your rover program and the current rover program, is the landing system not being predicted by anybody in science fiction. You know, this simple bounce, bounce, bounce to land. It was just so simple.
It's not simple. I don't have 150 pyrotechnic events had to work for that thing to work.
Like I said, it was so complex.
Thank you.
We tend to write what is believable in science.
I didn't believe that stuff for a minute.
No, I still don't. I think it's all made up.
But we always have the typical rocketry entry that science fiction from Rocky Jones, Space Ranger, is the same way we back the spaceship down with retro rockets, and this was just so brilliant an idea.
Well, I want to bounce tourists down that way and see what the response will be. So.
No, you don't.
I think the G-loads would be a little interesting.
A little interesting, yeah.
So Albert and Alessa Donna, does that mean that this is now a very well-accepted the way to go for future missions, to bounce them down like that?
It is and it isn't, because...
Yeah, that's
because
the right answer.
Yeah, it worked really well for what we wanted to do and for the size of mission we've sent so far for Pathfinder and for the Mars Exploration Rovers. But you'll remember that we sweated getting off our lander and driving over
right.
those airbags that obstructed our driving. So sort of the next step and the next design may have similarities and yet differences. We may try and get away from the airbags and do some sort of combination. I think the idea is sort of a sky crane, where you come down with the retro rockets up on the back shell that are doing a controlled touchdown of the rover that's more or less by itself on a tether without airbags. That's sort of where it's headed.
I can't see a Jim Carrey landing on Mars comedy involving a bounce down, though. I think that would be very appropriate.
Yeah, I once thought we ought to do a theme park ride with that.
Hey.
I'm all in favor.
Right next to the Space Needle, I can see.
The fact is that the scaling up the airbags, they've scaled up about as much as you can do it. And the two Viking missions worked just fine with retro rockets. And the only reason we went to airbags was because it was believed if we were just like Viking, we would be expensive. And so they had to come up with something else. It wasn't that there was anything wrong with the rockets.
All right. We're going to take a short
break. In fact, we use rockets with our airbags.
All right, we'll talk about it some more. But we have to take a short break to pay some bills, so stay with us. We'll be right back. Don't go away. We'll talk more about Mars, Mars science, and science fiction. We'll be right back after this break. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about Mars and science fiction and science fact, and we're broadcasting from the Science Fiction Museum and Hall of Fame in Seattle, just opening today in Seattle, Washington, with my guest, Donna Shirley, who's director of said museum, Gregory Benford and Greg Baer, both award-winning, you know their names, they're science fiction writers, Albert Haldeman, who's deputy project scientist for Mars Exploration Rover at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, JPL, in Pasadena, California. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. Go to the phones. Hi, let's go to Mary in Richmond, California. Hi, Mary.
Hi. I have a couple of comments. One is, the little that I know about the cost of sending human beings to space is that it is at least triple what it would cost to provide national health care in this country. And also, we have completely wreaked havoc with the environment and on this planet. Why isn't it as important to devote your creativity and your money and your energy to working things out right here? I understand. I love science fiction. I'm totally fascinated by the things the rover is learning. I really don't see why we need to send a human being there, and I'm not sure it makes any sense. I mean, my vision of that is that we're going to wreck Mars, too.
Greg Baer held his hand up to answer that question.
It's a great question, and it has a pretty simple answer. What if we waited to clean up our house and clean the bathrooms and make our beds before we ever stepped outside the door? How often will we step outside the door, and how boring would life be? We can't get our lives completely organized in the individual to wait until we have organized the entire planet to do marvelous things like travel into space would just put an end to all these big endeavors. I think we need to have a mix of the practical, of the helping hand, and of the visionary, because we all live in a world that's really very, very exciting if we just look up from the dirt.
But we live in a really exciting exciting world right here. I mean, why can't you get excited about what's happening right here and, making this the visionary place? And you guys are all really smart and you have resources. And I mean, what's the problem with getting excited about what's here?
Donna?
I think we're very excited about what's here. And if you look at writers like Octavia Butler, for instance, that's what she focuses on is anthropology, basically, and Ursula K. Le Guin and people like that. However, you know, people do not understand how little we spend on the space program. We spend, for instance, more on dog food, dog treats, doggy treats in this country than we spent on the two Mars rover projects. The NASA budget is actually...
space, that changes completely.
No, wait. The entire NASA budget's $14 billion a year, which wouldn't even touch Star Wars. So if you want to save money, I would suggest you save it on building stupid systems like the Star Wars missile defense system.
Well, I agree with that. Maybe you could put your energy into seeing how that could happen. You know what I mean? I mean,
there's a different perspective. Let's imagine that Ferdinand and Isabella made your argument.
Then the Native Americans would still be here.
Yeah, nobody else. But solving the problems of Europe actually required the perspectives and resources of the New World.
Right. So what's wrong with just the rover? I totally agree. It's
okay.
Fascinating, and we need to explore, but we don't really need to send a person there.
All right,
That's
Mary.
That's what I'm saying.
Okay, thank you. Thanks for calling. 1-800-989-8255. Let's go to the audience here. Yes.
Hi. It seems to me that the technologies we'd have to master in order to live long-term in either space or the moon or some other hostile environment would be much like the same technologies we'd have to master in order for humans to be able to live on Earth with zero ecological impact.
Good point.
Would you agree? And if so, what sorts of things do you see that are being developed now that might be useful?
Actually, I don't think you can ever live anywhere with zero ecological impact. After all, you're still going to cast a shadow. But I think, in fact, some of the technologies we would develop would have spinoffs that would help us here. I don't think they're hugely difficult. People like Bob Zubrin have spelled out a really cheap way to go to Mars, and I think most people think going to Mars would be, from a NASA perspective, $50 billion. Roughly four times, 4 years of the NASA budget. The space station cost $100 billion. And we haven't learned a thing from the space station about biology because we're not living in space. We're camping in space. We actually need a different emphasis. We need to try to figure out how to live in these places, just as you say. We don't recycle significantly on the space station. So that's still a frontier waiting to be opened.
Albert, Haldeman, being there at JPL and helping design these future missions, do people there read science fiction books and say, hey, there's an interesting, great idea we might think of? Or see a little movie?
I don't know,
or...
although I think certainly my background has been motivated by reading science fiction through the years. And I want to come back to my earlier point that to address the previous question from Mary, that robots can do a lot and it's very exciting, but we're going to have to wait. So if that's okay, if we can all be patient and say find out what those other minerals are to really understand the water at Meridiani, if we can wait 6 to 10 to 15 years for that answer, then that's fine. But I think when you send the humans, you will accelerate the rate of the exploration and the rate of return of the knowledge. So maybe that's what we want to do. Maybe we do want to spend, 3 times more, 10 times more to get the humans there than we're spending on the robots. But then we'll get the information back maybe 10 times faster or 10 times more of it. And that has value, too, by putting that perspective of us here on Earth in the perspective of the greater solar system and learning about our place in the solar system, making the Earth more special thereby. And that has value.
Let's go to Julian in Brown Summit, North Carolina. Hi, Julian.
Hey, how are you?
Hi, go ahead.
Well, first of all, I'd like to say that I'm tickled to death that some of my tax money goes to some enterprise like this. I've always loved space exploration. I'm an old man, and I've been watching it since Alan Shepard wrote that Redstone rocket. And I'm on the website every night looking at the rover mission. And my question is, although the raw pictures are great and some of the remarks are terrific, I read them religiously, when are we going to have some definitive science from this mission to read on that website? And how long can these rovers possibly keep on exploring the planet?
Albert?
To the first question, we have... we're following the scientific process. The definitive science has to pass the peer review process. So we have papers submitted that are explaining our discoveries, the quantitative science. They're being peer reviewed to be published in the journal Science sometime later this summer, our initial results, and there'll be more coming in the year ahead. So that stuff will be available more likely in libraries than directly on the website. I forgot the second part of the question. How long the rovers will last? Yes, I think the engineers are betting all but one of them. We're willing to bet that at least one rover will see the first anniversary of Spirit's landing. So we are making plans for a second extended mission beyond September, beyond the solar conjunction, when the sun starts coming south again to keep doing good science and good exploration into the next calendar year.
Does that mean that the solar panels are getting less dusty than you thought they might be? Because I'd understood that was always the limiting factor.
No, they're still getting dusty, and we are going to have to cope with that. But the fact that if we can survive the northern summer, i.e. Mm-hmm. southern winter, in particular with Spirit, which is at 15 degrees latitude south, and then the sun comes back south again, just the cosine effect of the solar insulation on the solar panels will give us another boost in energy for a few more months that we could be able to use if nothing breaks during the hibernation phase in the middle of winter.
Mm-hmm. Do you have a question here, lady on this side of the audience?
It seems that science and science fiction in this museum and this program give us a sense of wonder, and that's a very important emotion or drive, and that's going to affect us whether we go to Mars as humans or what we do here. But all of it's important because it does give us that strong emotion.
That's a spiritual emotion. The thing we see going through the Science Fiction Museum is that connection to your imagination, which gives you the energy not just to get through the day, but to move on and do more extraordinary things on the next day. We've got many programs coming up here, educational programs at the Science Fiction Museum. We could have kids coming to Your Trip to Mars workshop starting next Saturday, June 26th, and that'll be held at the Experience Music Project building. We have all these educational outreach programs coming on, and we're really going to have a lot of fun inspiring that sense of wondering, engaging children and thinking about the future.
We're talking about Mars this hour and Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. We're running at, well, we're beginning to run down on the clock here. Any final thoughts on the interface of science fiction and Mars and how they might influence each other? Are we running out of interesting things to write about in Mars? Because science has overtaken Mars, you know?
Not
science?
At all.
No.
No.
I don't think so.
Gregory Brentford?
I believe that Mars, you don't have to explain to the layman. Mm-hmm. He's been educated by science fiction writers and scientists alike for 100 years to expect that big things will come from Mars and go there. I think that doing it within a human scale of time makes sense. The present Bush initiative says we'll go to Mars sometime after 2030, which means no one in the present astronaut corps will ever go to Mars. Hard to inspire people that way. So I think we actually should shorten the horizon. It is not obvious that people 50 years from now will have the means to go to Mars, you know? Mm-hmm. That happened to Leif Erikson, remember?
Well, I wasn't around, but I heard about it.
I went to school with him.
But you're also losing the whole generation, as you say, a whole generation, Donna, of people who... can you recruit people to come to something that's so nebulous, a career?
Leslie Howell, our education outreach manager, standing over there by the microphone, and she has put together a fantastic program for kids. Mm-hmm. We had a whole bunch of school kids come through here in a practice session, and the middle school kids were fascinated. They were really, the high school kids kind of blew through and went off and partied, you know, but the middle school kids were absolutely fascinated. And when I talk to groups of middle school children in school, mm-hmm. they're absolutely fascinated. So I think we can capture a generation, and that science fiction is the way to do it.
All right. I think we've run out of time. I'd like to thank all my guests this hour for taking time to talk with us. Donna Shirley, director of the Science Fiction Museum, a Hall of Fame in Seattle. Gregory Benford is a Nebula Award-winning author whose books include The Martian Race and Timescape. Professor of Plasma Physics and Astrophysics, University of California, Irvine. Do you have a new book that you're working on?
Just had one come out called Beyond Infinity.
That's a long distance. That's far away.
That's stolen from Buzz Lightyear.
No, he stole it from me.
Greg Baer, a Hugo and Nebula Award-winning author of Moving Mars, Darwin's Children, and Deadlines. You working on something?
I'm working on a new book now, but Deadlines is my most recent book, and it's a high-tech ghost story right here on Earth.
Hmm. And you're not going to run out of, as you say, both of you, neither are you going to run out of Mars.
No problem.
Is Mars still a hot thing?
Mars is very hot. I'll make a prediction right here. I think that within the next 15 years, we will know the answer of whether or not there is life on a world off the Earth. And I think we will get those results very likely from Mars.
Yeah, and they'll be positive, I expect.
I think they'll be positive.
Do you write about maybe some of these moons of Jupiter? You know, we talk about sending probes?
Europa and Ganymede and all these places. They may have hidden oceans.
Right.
We have had John Delaney and Deb Kelly come out here. They are experts on the extremophiles that live deep in our oceans off the Juan de Fuca Trench. And
right.
No, I think the possibilities are huge.
All right. We're gonna stay in touch. Also, keep paying attention to Albert Haldeman and his group over there at JPL. He's Deputy Project Scientist for the Mars Exploration Rover at JPL. And good luck to you, Albert, and your missions out there. And thank you all for joining us today. Kevin Wade is our technical director. Our audio engineers are Stacy Abbott in Seattle, Matt Galick in New York, Neil Tivault and Vince Muse in Washington, Jeff Krynock in Pasadena. Also, thanks to Trevor Anthony and all the nice folks at the Science Fiction Museum and Hall of Fame here in Seattle. Greg Smith composed our theme music, and we had help today from NPR librarians Kim Molesky and Alphonse Finn. If you missed any of the comments we talked about today, surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com. We have all the links that you might have missed. Also, back editions of Science Friday on Real Audio, and you can download them on your Audible player. Have a great weekend. We'll see you next week back in New York. I'm Ira Flatow in Seattle.